Welcome back to another episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts, just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I am Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And joining us today, gentlemen, we've got two guys who are no strangers, to say the least, to the world of by-minute podcasting. And we got Pete Mummert and Tom Taylor from the Indiana Jones Minute. Welcome, guys.
Hey, thank you.
Yeah, thanks for
having
us.
Good to be here.
We're really glad to have you. Now, I think Brian is going to tell us a little bit about what's going on in this particular minute.
I'm going to tell you about minute eight of this wonderful movie. In the shattered church, Johann Schmidt presses the etched eye of a serpent on the ancient wooden artwork. A hidden drawer with a wooden lid slides open. Schmidt lifts the lid and is bathed in a radiant blue light. He gazes into it, his face alight with triumph. And the Fuhrer digs for trinkets in the desert. Talking about this later. Schmidt continues to peer into the box. The glow illuminates his features. He says to the churchkeeper, "You have never seen this, have you?" The churchkeeper says, "It's not for the eyes of ordinary men." "Exactly," Schmidt says, his tone sharp with conviction. "I'm going to act it out." Schmidt snaps the box shut, the light vanishing. He turns to several of his troops. "Give the order to open fire," he commands. The churchkeeper's eyes blaze with defiance. "Fool, you cannot control the power you hold. You will burn." Schmidt's lips curl into a cold smile. "I already have."
It's a shame the audience can't see this, but Brian, a little bit of the red makeup is showing through underneath. Just a hint of red skull. And what a perfect minute. So, Pete and Tom, do you guys know anything about the Fuhrer hunting for trinkets in the desert? Has that ever come up in conversation?
Not ringing bell with you guys? At all. No. Okay. No. Well, I thought he had a war to fight. What's he looking for trinkets in the desert for?
He's looking for trinkets in the desert.
How about this? Especially after all that business in 1936 when he was an utter failure and it blew up in his face, almost literally. What's he still out there for?
Well, I got to say, the first time I saw this movie, when it first came out, when that line came up, I laughed my head off because I knew what they were doing. I knew exactly what they were doing.
Oh, you know who it's a nod to. It's the man in the fedora.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, Jim and Brian, we're going to have to see if we get Hitler on the show later in this endeavor.
I think
you never know.
Something we've got to work on, yes.
Hitler or a reasonable facsimile.
Well, yeah, as we are, getting here deep into World War II, the Marvel World War II versus many other movies' versions of World War II, I was thinking, you guys have been following Indiana Jones for so long, and the most recent movie as the time of this recording, because who knows what there could be another. You finally got into a movie where you have World War II Indy, and I'm not sure if that was ever in any of young Indiana Jones, but is this the only venture other than the video games where Indy and World War II cross paths?
As far as I know, we're not necessarily the ones to ask about young Indiana Jones Chronicles because we watched one or two for our bonus show, but it's not for us. We like the movie. We like Harrison Ford in the movies. And not even all the movies. No, of course we like all the movies.
I'm curious if he shows up in the comic books.
Maybe. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, I mean, I think I remember a long time ago there was an Indiana Jones and the Spear of Destiny video game. This was way back in the
early
Ice
LucasArts.
Age.
Yeah.
And that would have been an intriguing thing. I mean, it does come up in the beginning of the latest movie. I think they talk about the spear. So, I don't know. And with bringing in other franchises, Hal and I have delved into The Rocketeer, and it always seemed like they were just on the verge of getting into World War II and chatting about that. But for the amount of time we spend dealing with Nazis and Hitler in all of our franchises, it's amazing that World War II is kind of like we just hit the margins of it and then don't get into the thick.
Yeah.
True. Until now.
Yeah.
I think
it's harder to have Americans or Brits and Germans interact too when they're actually at war. Oh. Like I think it makes it a little easier to come up with stories with them interacting where they're definitely not on the same side, but they're not, you know, there aren't guns being fired at each other.
Right. It's yeah. that whole Casablanca thing.
I was just going to say Casablanca. Yeah. Right.
Yeah, some tense interpersonal drama and, you know, on the eve of global conflict.
Yeah, because then you're like, well, wait, why? Like, unlike in Captain America, you're like, wait, why isn't he fighting the war? Why is he doing archaeology during the middle of the war?
Well, and I imagine too, there's some hesitancy on the part of the filmmakers to really get in there with what's, you know, more or less light entertainment. We don't want to be talking about, you know, millions of people dying when we're talking about Captain America and Indiana Jones. It runs the risk of trivializing a very dark period of history.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're dealing with that with our Dial of Destiny discussion because, yeah, like all the, you know, the Nazis have figured largely into like Raiders and Last Crusade and stuff, but they are kind of not cartoony necessarily, but they are all they're the bad guys. It's a bad guy army, whereas Dial of Destiny sort of touches on the ideology behind that and like why they're Nazis, why they were the enemy. So it gets a little real. It makes Pete anxious, and I can understand why. Yeah. a little too real for Indiana Jones, maybe.
It brings me back to the moment in The Last Crusade where you know, Indy and his dad attend a book burning. Uh-huh. And it's just chilling. It's chilling that those guys are there in that, and they're powerless. They can't do anything to stop it, or they literally can't do anything. But it's just it's a chilling insertion of reality into this light fantasy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
And although we're going to be, you know, this is many, many, many episodes ahead of us, the idea that we, you know, here we are in a minute with Red Skull, and Hitler isn't bad enough. So,
yeah, <they'd> be-
right. Yeah.
Yeah. To take Hitler and the SS and then say, but wait a minute, you know, let's talk about Hydra and, you know, you want to see something really scary?
No. Have there been so many like Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck cartoons about Hitler that he's just too funny now? Like he's like, if you had him as a bad guy in a movie, would he just be kind of laughable? So you need a Red Skull to like actually be like, even Indiana Jones, he signs his book and he's a goofball.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, he's like the Yosemite Sam of World War II. It's just
right. Well, even in the comic books, the Red Skull was always sort of a Frankenstein's creation that his creator Hitler could not control. As far back as his original appearances, the Red Skull was maybe not worse than Hitler, but more chaotic than Hitler, and had his own agenda. Always had his own agenda, which is very much played out in this movie, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Can I ask a question about his car? I'm assuming you touched on this already, but is his car American or is it sure? To me, it feels like an American, like speedster, roadster, like that sleek styling.
Yeah, that's a really good question.
It's got a real Art Deco look to it. No.
Yeah.
I had a feeling it was more like a Duesenberg.
Was a Duesenberg, but you know, very sort of stylized and.
Yeah.
The almost a stretch.
I had a question for you guys, Pete and Tom, or anybody who can answer this. I am not a Hitler scholar, but there are so many works of fiction that deal with Hitler's interest in the occult.
Mm-hmm.
There's our movie. There's your movies. There's the Justice League of America had the whole Spear of Destiny thing. Is there any truth to that? Did Hitler really send archaeologists out throughout the world to find weird stuff to give him
absolutely.
Power?
Absolutely. Yeah, he absolutely did. It wasn't always so much driven by Hitler, but there were people in the Nazi party who were really into that. And they had, like Himmler had the whole Ahnenerbe organization where they were trying to find mythical artifacts that they thought would prove the power of the Aryan race, and they sent them everywhere. Like they went to Tibet, they went to South America, they went to the Middle East, everywhere trying to find to India to find what they thought were these artifacts that would either be magical and give them power or that would prove, you know, the superiority of the German race.
And that kind of comes up in this movie later.
Stanley
Tucci sort of explains that, like, yeah, for as far as Hitler was concerned, they were looking for this stuff for as a, like you're saying, Pete, like to prove that Germany was the one true awesome race or whatever, and rouse everybody up. Whereas Red Skull is like, no, it's actually magical and it's gonna give us immense power.
Yeah, and apparently he just never bothered with Norse mythology, so
right.
He'll be skipping Scandinavia.
Can I say? Oh, sorry.
Go ahead.
Are you suggesting he could have found Mjolnir? Is that what you're going for?
Oh,
he couldn't have lifted it.
Well, I like that he comes up and he presses this button. In every single movie I've seen in the last 30 years, I was expecting that drawer to go and have like a technology sound and slide out and all this stuff. And I love that he pressed the button and then he just pulled it. Pulled it out. That was a really nice, unexpected change.
The beauty of IKEA or something. well, wrong country, but it's nice. It has a very, that whole door that we were looking at, the tree of life, the woodworking and stuff like that. It feels more nature minded. I mean, as we're going to get into in like later movies, like Thor and stuff like that, it's less, although there's a lot of technology going on in this, there's also that mystic power that we're going to, you know, that they're building up to in the Avengers series, that they're trying to kind of combine mysticism, well, like in Indiana Jones, it's combining mysticism and technology. Although I don't know if technology except for your last movie, I don't know if technology takes a front seat in a lot of the plot
lines. Feel like it kind of did in Crystal Skull, depending on how you look at Crystal Skull.
Sure.
That's true. Sure.
Yeah.
A very advanced technology.
Yeah. And the dial of destiny is basically technological.
Yeah.
Yeah. I can see that. I think when they focus on the technology, they lose the plot in all of these things, even though, like, you know, Steve Rogers is going to get this super serum, which is a technical thing. He's the only one in, you know, Arthurian type of he's the guy that's noble enough to take this medication to make the weak man strong.
It's interesting though. I mean, like, I was thinking about that in regards to, you know, a lot of these movies have gods, deities, you know, from various civilizations leaving some kind of really, really powerful object on Earth in the care of like some old men. I feel like at some point they're not making great choices leaving this stuff out for people.
Yeah, I think of the Grail Knight for 700 years wasn't exactly in top form to defend it as he hefts his sword and falls over.
Like, whoever left the Tesseract here should have also said, okay, now here's something that'll stop a tank. Yeah, you don't know what a tank is yet.
Yeah,
right.
Whatever.
Yeah,
there's a handy guidebook. A readme.
The century by century guide to what you're going to have to fight against.
And when you have like just a kind of a brotherhood of guardians, the problem with that too is it only takes one guardian to go bad, or like one guardian to be like, well, maybe I'll use this. Like, I feel like there are a lot of flaws in this logic, but it's real world logic. Like, I feel like this is intrinsic in a lot of religions or a lot of, you know, ancient civilizations.
But as I recall, the backstory is that, you know, 1,000 or 1,500 years ago or however long ago, Odin fought off fought frost giants in this place, in this land.
Uh-huh.
And that's how the Tesseract got left there in the care of these people who had proved themselves to be noble, courageous stewards of this awesome power. That's what I recall the backstory is. Now I'm going to have to read up on that. Jim might edit this out later. I think that's right. I think a battle between Asgard and Frost giants took place, and that's how the Tesseract ended up there.
Talking about the Marvel backstory?
Like, no, the
actual Nordic
real world backstory.
Okay,
the real world
mythology, as opposed to the mythological mythology.
No, within the world of the movie itself.
Okay.
And I'm just pulling this all out of the back of my brain, so I'll look that up later.
we'll leave it as an exercise for the listeners.
Yes, please.
It's funny, as we're recording this, for the past 3 days, my wife and I have been rewatching Lord of the Rings, the extended edition. So we just plowed on through it for the past 3 days.
Oh, nice.
And I can't help but think that Hugo Weaving doesn't play a good guy. It's just, he's been so typecast. You know, if he's not Agent Smith, he's the Red Skull. And when I'm watching him as Elrond, I keep feeling like he's got to be plotting something.
He's up to something. Yeah. He's got something behind his back.
Don't try.
We should explain to Pete Lord of the Rings is a series of movies about these books, and Hugo Weaving here plays Elrond. He's an elf. I know he's tall, but elves are tall and those things, so it's okay.
Well, speaking of Hugo Weaving, Tom and I were chatting before this, and I tend not to be a big superhero movie fan, but I was telling Tom I enjoyed this movie. But one of the questions I had was, is The Matrix a superhero movie? And we decided it wasn't, but we were sort of wondering, what is it that makes a movie a superhero movie?
My argument, but the reason I knocked it down from not being a suit, I don't know if that's a knockdown, but not being a superhero movie, but I was like, well, if The Matrix is a superhero movie, then so is Star Wars, because you've got like a sort of regular dude who becomes a hero, tapping into some power that he didn't know about,
getting superpowers and being a superhero of sorts,
becoming like a more powerful person than he was. He's just sort of a schlub at first, and then I guess you could say about, you know, Steve Rogers, I guess he's not a schlub, he's got a lot of spirit and a lot of, you know, can do energy, and he wants to do the right thing, and I don't know, but something's done to him to make him super powerful.
Well,
I don't know.
The Spider-Man, you're igniting an age old. Spider-Man is also a superhero in that case because something happened to him. He was just schlub.
It's an age old debate. Is Batman a superhero? He's just a guy in a suit. Is he a superhero? Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, like, is the fact that The Matrix wasn't a comic book first, does that immediately make it not a superhero? Like, would it be easier to call it a superhero movie if it had come from a comic book?
Hmm. Well, the ability to stop bullets, you do with I Batman. Think, might do it. I don't.
Yeah, I mean, he is super powered. Yeah, and like Luke Skywalker is super powered in a way.
Well, not at first though. So I mean, right. is no, he? No. He, I mean, he might not like, be a superhero in Star Wars, but by the time he gets to,
Return of the Jedi.
Return of the Jedi, I would say, when he can start doing, waving his hand and stopping odd creatures from thinking the way that they do.
Well, it does turn off his targeting computer.
He does.
That's true.
I mean, it's all kind of Joseph Campbell, Hero with a Thousand Faces kind of thing, isn't it? Where, your hero goes through a thing and comes out the other thing as a hero. And it's not a blueprint or a recipe, but it's an understanding of how an ordinary schlub, as you say, becomes a hero. So then you throw the word super on it. I kind of agree with if you're stopping bullets and you can fly, I think you're a superhero.
All right.
I feel that same way. But then what would take Captain America? So instead of getting this super serum, Steve Rogers, eats his Wheaties and has a balanced breakfast and just works out a lot and becomes really strong and just becomes really good at being a soldier. Yeah. Maybe he's the best soldier in the entire army. I mean, there's individual things he couldn't accomplish in this film, but you could follow at least roughly the same general arc. Now, granted, without the serum, he probably doesn't survive, spoiler alert, being frozen, for 80 years. But what is that movie then? Is it just a hero movie?
That's a good question. Or what about Flash Gordon?
Sergeant York.
Yeah, there you go, right? Sergeant York.
I can picture many people in their cars or on Pelotons yelling at our speakers right now.
Of course it is.
It's an old debate. I mean, Zorro, the Shadow, pick your old-timey hero.
Yeah.
The Rocketeer.
I don't know.
Yeah, the Rocketeer.
Yeah.
Columbo. Green Hornet.
Yeah, Columbo.
Guy's brilliant. It's unhuman.
And does Flash Gordon lose points for having been a different kind of hero already?
Well, he was a quarterback,
He was like a hero for the Jets. He was like a sports star. Yeah.
Your mention of Hugo Weaving brought something to mind, in that he seems to, just as an actor, really enjoy doing mask work where his real face isn't visible. He was in V for Vendetta. He's the Red Skull here. And there's this whole, and I'm not an actor, I don't know much about it, but there's this whole strain of acting called mask work, where you have a mask on going back hundreds of years and you act through the mask. And I just wonder if he's, if he's interested in that, if that's something that really appeals to him, a role that you literally disappear into. You could watch a whole movie and not know Hugo Weaving's in it.
Mm.
Right.
I think that's interesting.
That is.
Yeah.
And you wonder too, if that's something that, as an actor, and that's what you do and that's what you appreciate, are you thinking of it as, I'm not singing a cappella, I'm holding an instrument in my hands and playing along and making music. I'm using these tools to sort of enhance or change or whatever the expressions that I've got.
Right.
And I would ask, is Andy Serkis the ultimate example of somebody who's into mask work with his, you know, being certainly probably the most famous motion capture actor?
Yeah.
I believe he was in that Lord of the Rings picture you were talking about there, Jim. Yeah.
I was thinking of the antithesis of that is when you see Ian McKellen, do you think of him as Magneto or do you think, oh, it's Ian McKellen again? Look, he's always playing and he's always giving the same line delivery. So I don't feel like it's Ian McKellen. Well,
Roddy McDowell. That is true of like most like Hollywood stars, you know, like most this movie stars. Had one. Like, oh, there's Leonardo DiCaprio. There's,
this movie had Samuel L. Jackson.
Yeah.
It does. Yeah.
That's true. Samuel L. Jackson as, you know,
as just Samuel L. Jackson. Yes.
Purple lightsaber, eye patch, whatever. That's fine. It's all good. Yeah,
Although David Bradley does get to play in this, he's playing the church keeper, but, you know, generally you're seeing him as the secondary character, and I've noticed that you can't think of his character name when you see him in something else. Like, what was his character name in Game of Thrones? I don't know.
he's
that guy.
Him, though.
He's that guy. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's always good at it.
Yeah, yeah, you believe him totally. He's very well invested. I mean, trying to keep your hair that straggly through so many different franchises—it's amazing. Yeah. But he does do a good. I try to figure out what the church keeper's job, like, is that passed down from, you know, like generation to generation? Have there been 700 years of church keepers, and is it a family thing? And
not anymore.
No. We're done and done here. Yeah.
But there's like a Dalai Lama situation where he dies and they have to find his next reincarnation.
It was going to be that guy who got crushed under the wall, but that.
Yeah. He's that.
And he just sold his condo and everything.
Yeah,
exactly. Was ready for the next step.
He says it's not for the eyes of ordinary men. So does that mean every church keeper has, you know, don't look in the box? Okay, I mean, none of them bothered to, you know, like pick up the lid and go, ooh, I shouldn't have done that.
There's probably that like so thing. And so the curious who peeked in the box. And the shortest tenure of any of them.
Yeah, blind Olaf, they called him. Yeah. Blind
Olaf. Well, sometimes you got to pick one and make an example.
Yeah, that's
right. You
know, yeah. Don't forget about Olaf.
Don't be a blind Olaf. Blind Olaf.
I had one more question. Is glowing light, you know, in so many of these movies, supernatural power is shown by glowing light. And I'm curious if that is just movie shorthand, if there's something like that we intrinsically as human beings, you know, almost primarily associate glowing light with divinity or with supernatural power.
You got halos.
Yeah. The transfiguration.
And people who either can or certainly at least claim to see people's auras.
Yeah.
Or even just like the sun. Like you've got the sun that a lot of people have worshipped over the years.
You know,
like that is a god to a lot of people. And it's like the most powerful thing you can see here from Earth.
Film is a visual medium. You have to have something happen. You can't open the box and have nothing, you know. Something's got to happen.
Yeah.
Look at that supernatural shade of beige.
Never seen such a plaid.
Emanating power. Never seen such a plaid.
It's so almost amber. Yeah. And it's always volumetric. There's never like it doesn't only light up the wall behind you. It lights up the air in between.
A mist
appears while it's lighting up.
You can't dust.
Interesting point about storytelling, though, is it has become this kind of shorthand that everybody seems to understand. And, you know, when you first mentioned it, the first thing I thought of was Pulp Fiction, where they open up the briefcase and it glows gold and you never find out what's in the briefcase. It's the MacGuffin of the story. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter, but it glows gold like 1,000 gold bars lit by a Klieg light, you know? It may have been.
Yeah.
They forgot to do that in 7 at the end of 7.
Yeah.
But I think it's interesting. I think it's become a kind of visual shorthand, and it sort of makes you wonder if somebody watches this movie in 100 years, would they get it? Would they understand that shorthand? Probably, but
is there a light bulb in that box? What's the big deal? Yeah, they have electricity back then. I don't get it.
But see, now I want someone to have open a box and you don't see anything, and they're like, I don't see anything. Well, that's because it's divine. You don't see the divine.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that in the end of your first movie, when he opens up the ark and there's nothing but sand and it's not glowing. But
yeah.
You only get the glowy ghost later.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It.
Which that would have been the time to leave.
Yeah.
It's sand. Quit while you're ahead.
Well, nothing here, boys.
Wow. I try to figure out how much. Well, as we're watching this in relationship to the entire cinematic universe that Marvel is about to build. I wish, well, if we ever get Kevin Feige on, which fingers crossed, he hasn't said no yet, but I'd like to know how much they considered the Tesseract as part of the Infinity Stones. Now, Brian, you...
The answer to this.
I do, too, yeah.
They made it up as they went along, more or less. Kevin Feige may contradict me on this, but I've read many articles, many interviews with the showrunners of these movies, and... they were making it up. I mean, the Tesseract in the comics is a device called the Cosmic Cube.
Hmm.
And it is nothing but that. It's not a jewel of anything, or it's not something Thanos wanted. It's the Cosmic Cube that can wish, that can make any wish you want come true. That's its power. And it's been the bugaboo between the Red Skull and Captain America for, gosh, probably 60 years now.
Oh, wow.
So I think it's only meant to be the Cosmic Cube. And I don't know why they didn't call it the Cosmic Cube, maybe because that sounds kind of stupid and comic booky. But then later on, when the Thor movies, there's that whole liquid red mist that inhabits Jane Foster.
Mm-hmm.
That was retconned into being kind of a Cosmic Cube or a Infinity Gem later. But I don't think that was meant to be an Infinity Stone either when they introduced it. I think they... kind of said, hey, look what we got here. We got a blue glowy thing and a red glowy thing. Let's make five more or four more glowy things,
Yeah. It worked.
I think I'm right on this. I've read the interviews with many of the people who made these movies, and they are more or less winging it.
Huh.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We'll pick Kevin's brain if he ever comes on, please come. As we're going into this, getting back to what we've all been doing, movies by minute stuff, I think Hal and I are into somewhere around 400 or 500 episodes now.
Wow,
man. It just keeps going and going.
Think
and going.
What we could have done with our lives.
Yeah. But we're pikers compared to Indiana Jones. You've got to be in quadruple digits by now, I would think, aren't you? Or
man, you gotta make me do math, and the result is gonna depress me. I don't know, like 120-ish times four, because we're doing the fifth movie 3 minutes at a time, so that's cheating. But
it's pushing 500 at least.
Yeah, plus Patreon. So you've got
Oh God, yeah.
Yeah, you've got your Patreons rolling out. Yeah. And it's like
I wonder we're tired.
Yeah. I mean, I think between with us, I think we've both been doing about 9 years worth of this stuff. So it's just, it's amazing that we still have things to talk about.
I hope that's the case.
Yeah. I'm not sure that's the case for me.
Right. You have to keep poking Pete with a stick.
And Jim and I didn't meet in person until we'd done 80 episodes together.
Oh, wow.
The Rocketeer Minute.
Chicago?
Yeah, it was that Chicago time? Movies by Minutes okay. we all yeah. went
oh,
to.
Oh, cool. Okay.
And I think we've covered our backstory before, but it was Brian who introduced us. And as we're recording this episode, Brian and I have never met in person.
Neither. I've never met Brian.
Oh, seriously?
Yeah. No.
Oh, that's true to me. Because Brian introduced you and me, and I thought you guys had known each other.
Yeah.
Has anybody ever met Brian?
No. I'm an AI creation.
Yeah.
That's some pretty good AI. I mean,
speaking of AI, while you were talking, I looked up. My interpretation of the Cosmic Cube Tesseract thing is correct. It was a later retcon to make it one of the. One of the Infinity Stones. So
that's exactly what an AI would say, but
yes, and I'm an AI consulting an AI here.
Yeah. Well, what I was getting to in movies by minutes, I mean, we've been going on for about a decade here, and thankfully Star Wars Minute got us all getting us to do this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But I keep wondering if podcasting, how long podcasting is going to be doing, it's going to be a thing.
I mean, yeah.
It's like, is it going to go the way of AM radio or, you know, cable TV and things like that? It's every there's new things that come on. But you know, this whole this asynchronous discussions that people wait for the next day's episode, or they can go in and binge, you know, like people can listen to our past couple of years, and you'll hear, we still hear from people from like 5 or 6 years ago saying, hey, that was a great episode you did. Whatever happened to, tell me where, what were we talking about? And what was the movie?
You're asking 2018, Jim. I don't know.
Yeah. It's, exactly. I don't know what, you know, I don't know where Helen Hayes is buried. I'm sorry. you know, it doesn't feel as long as it has been.
But, no, yeah, that's true. Know,
it's just amazing that this is still going on. There's people that are still asking questions and wanting to make shows about movies. I'm glad it does because it's still. I mean, I still listen to you guys, and you still come up with great topics and things like that. Especially Jerry.
Absolutely, especially Jerry.
He's so interesting, he couldn't be here tonight.
I'm sure he's listening to this one and just dreading not being on the show.
Yeah, gnashing his teeth.
It's okay, Jerry.
Wow. So as you know, as we're recording this, you're doing Dial of Destiny 3 minutes at a time. Are you finding that format easier or easier to talk about coherent topics than, say, you're watching a minute of the movie and all of a sudden it cuts off and you really wanted to get to the next 10 seconds of it?
Yeah, I think we knew pretty, you know, the movie came out and we're like, okay, I guess we have to do this movie, but it feels like we should wait 10 or 15 years before we do it because it seems unnatural to do it a minute at a time, like right after the movie came out. So 3 minutes at a time makes sense because, yeah, I think we'd go insane trying to do it 1 minute at a time just because, you know, I mean, I think the Venn diagram for the perfect movies by minute movie topic is like, you know, you have to, you've lived the movie for, I don't know, years, decades, maybe since you were a kid, or at least, you know, a couple of decades, you know, it backwards and forwards. You love it. You could launch into 50 hours of conversation right now without even the microphones being on. And that was the case more or less with the other movies, the other Indiana Jones movies. But Dial of Destiny was like a year old or something when we started recording. So it needed a little foot on the gas,
yeah,
I guess.
Marinating, just letting it park. And the other weird part is that sometimes on the newer movies, you haven't had the conversations with people because, as you said, these are stuff you may have talked about in high school when you saw a movie. And you're like, oh, right, yeah. Back to the Future. Yeah. Not, yeah. And now it's like, well, who am I talking to? I talk to my wife. And I might call somebody and say, did you go see that movie? Did you like it or not? What was, you know?
Like Pete kept saying in like the first, some of our first episodes, he kept saying like, it'll be really interesting when these start airing and like, I'll know what people think about this movie. I don't actually know what people think about this movie.
Yeah.
Like,
but it's always interesting to me too, to revisit a movie you loved when you were young as an adult.
Yeah,
sometimes they don't hold up at all. And sometimes you see new richness and things that you never saw before when you were a kid. And I think that's, again, part of the beauty of the marinating process, coming to a movie, not just immediately, but 5, 10, 20, 30 years down the road, is you get different perspective on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A little wisdom, maybe.
Yeah. And even if you find out that it doesn't hold up, you might still adore it
just as much
and still have a ton to talk about.
Yeah. But, considering Hal's undying love for Haley Atwell.
A three-way boxing match.
Get in line, Hal. Get in line.
I was going to say.
But one thing about the minute format that I think I like better than the 3 minute format is there's a Flaubert quote I've always liked, and he says, for something to be interesting, you only need to look at it long enough. And when you look at these things, when you dissect them to such a small degree, I mean, I do a movie podcast, but I wouldn't call myself a movie guy. And I think one of the interesting things to me is when you take these tiny looks at a segment of a movie, you find all of these interesting things that are not related to it being a movie. Like you find interesting things about the history or about the people or stories, or it's just, there's so many interesting ways you can go in every single minute. It's just amazing how many fun things you can find in a minute of something you look at.
Yeah.
Jim, all I can think of is, pardon me, but the episode of the October Sky Minute where we had a riveting conversation about the history of the picket fence.
Yes.
Exactly.
With
a
jump off into the history of the front porch.
That's
his goal.
There may have only been three people in the world who found that interesting, but darn it.
Being able to talk riveting. To the fourth generation of the guy that ran the Peerless Handcuffs company.
Yeah, right? that's so great.
I didn't know that they were the dread enemies of Smith and Wesson there. the Coke and Pepsi of the handcuffs. It was stunning. I'm tipping my hand to a future episode, but I'm trying to get somebody from the Littmann Stethoscope Company when they're because if you go to any hospital, any emergency room, any doctor's office, and you look at what's hanging around their neck, you'll see that big script L. Oh, wow. And I noticed this in the HBO series The Pitt. Everybody's got a Littmann stethoscope, but from what I understand in talking with several doctors now, you either wear a Littmann or you are considered an outcast. You went and bought the Timu version.
Timu stethoscope.
So it's a Harbor Freight of stethoscopes. You want that script L. So no offense to Harbor Freight people out there who might be listening. So anyway, hopefully we'll have a Littmann representative on the show later when we're doing Doctor
Who.
But Pete, like you said, it gives you the opportunity, it gives you the excuse to talk about stuff you would never have any idea about what was going on. And you know, it just when you drop that in an email to invite somebody on the show, this is probably their favorite topic. Mm-hmm. So being able to just hook into them and say, hey, would you like to talk about stethoscopes or picket fences or handcuffs?
Yes.
Like we learned the difference between snakes and legless eels.
Yes, from John.
Oh, yeah.
And it was people still talk about that like years and years later. It seems like such a random thing, but some of these things really resonate with people.
I was flabbergasted when I learned that from the legless lizard. How's that not a snake? What's going on? What are you talking about?
Legless lizards. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, the world changed on that day.
It did. My eyes were open.
And it's like you said, it's amazing how things stick with you. I keep thinking, in Citizen Kane, Mr. Bernstein is talking about stuff that happened in the past. And he said he was getting on a ferry in 1896, and he saw a woman getting on a ferry opposite her. He said, I remember she had on a white hat, and it's been 40 years since I saw her, but not a week goes by that I don't think of her. And it's legless lizards are the same thing.
Yeah.
That's the woman on the ferry.
Exactly the same.
Well, speaking of legless lizards, this has been a unique episode that I'm sure everybody will remember for years to come. Remember the time that Jones Boys were on our show? Greatly appreciated having you on.
Oh, thanks for having us.
Of course.
I can strongly recommend listening to the Indiana Jones Minute and signing up for their Patreon, which is always it's a great show behind the show. You get a lot more experiences in life listening to their Patreon episodes. Thank you very much for being a part of this. I'd also like to thank our listeners for joining us. If you'd like to continue the conversation, we're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base on Facebook. If you do like our show, don't forget to subscribe and leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.